Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to another episode of Two Crickets and a Thorn Tree, the smoothest glass of Amarilla for your minds in the Southern Hemisphere. I'm half of your host, Nicholas Larimer, joined by Mr. Gabriel Krause, the other half.
Hello.
I can't tell. I think in this episode, one of us has got to be the ice and the other one has to be the Amarilla, but I'm not sure which.
Yes. I don't know. I think you might be in a more icy mood today. We'll see. So, we are back. We took a hiatus last week because Gabriel was very busy saving the country from great injustices, which he managed to do. And you should check out his coverage on Pete Retief and the murder case, or the alleged, or the murder accusations, rather, that were made there. It's some good stuff. Gabriel did some really good reporting, which helped to prevent what might have been a bit of a miscarriage of justice. If things had gone on. So very well done to you, Gabriel.
Thank you, sir. I don't know if I... Yeah, I'll just say thank you very much.
Yeah, well, look, you didn't... Whatever you did, you didn't hurt. You certainly, I think, improved the situation. So I just heard a story now, which I don't have all the details on, and I've heard it from second-hand sources, people who talk to first-hand sources about what's going on in the town. And it's worth flagging. Watch the news for it. They may not be reporting on it because South Africa's media is very interested in publishing press releases and leaked information from ANC factions, but doesn't always do that much original reporting.
Yeah.
I'm painting with a broad brush there. There's certainly exceptions, but some of the, I would guess you might sarcastically call them the prestige media, definitely that does describe them.
I like that phrase.
There's a town in Northern Cape called Prieska.
Town might be stretching it.
Yeah, 14,000 people in the middle of the desert, absolutely tiny. It has a big copper mine near it, and apparently, last week, some dudes associated with the RET faction, the ANC, rolled into town. They were not friends with the local ANC, and they either fomented or encouraged, it's not entirely clear, some kind of service delivery protest. And so the version of the story I've heard is that basically they showed up at the mine and they said, and this was with several guys armed heavily with, I know assault rifle is not a very technical term, but I'm going to just use it now because most people know what that means. showed up with assault rifles and told the mine management, you're going to share 10% of the profits with the quote-unquote community, and we are the community, and you're going to give us all the subcontracting agreements and licenses and stuff for the mine as well, or else, well, there's going to be trouble. And then they tried to block off the town, and they burnt tires.
If this version was right, the headline would be something like, armed tenderpreneurs show up to strike a deal.
Right.
In front of mob that's burning tires in the streets.
So over the next couple of days, also there was allegedly a white teenage kid who was a farmer's son there who also got beaten up by some of these guys. And that, of course, made things worse because then you had a series of armed standoffs between the quote-unquote protesters and their security company. It's rather unusual for protesters to have a security company. Although, you know, stranger things have happened.
Yeah, it's very medieval. I feel no one in the 1500s would be surprised to have.
You've actually just reminded me of something that I'm going to mention after I finish telling the story. These dudes show up. There's a bunch of really tense standoffs that almost result in bloodshed between mine security, the protesters and their armed dudes, local farmers. And, there's not much action from the police. The police sent some people in to mediate, which consisted of basically asking everyone to just be nice to each other. So once again, the South African Police Service does not seem to be coming in guns blazing. I think no one would accuse them of doing that. Now, we don't know the situation entirely, so maybe that was the right call, but my gut feeling says no.
But we have heard that the mayor...
the ANC mayor is is trying to stand up to these guys. He's not associated. So it's definitely a different branch of the ANC. But he's not having much success either because it seems like the police are not really helping him out there, which is not great. So it's very nasty. There's obviously a sort of potential for this to be spun in a racial narrative way. But generally, I think it's kind of believable, this story, because it's the general disorder and chaos that is seeping in into South Africa, particularly in South Africa's rural areas, I mean, which we've seen numerous examples of recently.
Yeah, this story reminded me of my second last story in Mpumalanga, in Impuluzi, where after some serious failures on the part of some laborers at a sawmill in this little town in Impuluzi, which is very close to the Swazi border, people were fired, and it's very hard to fire people in South Africa because the labor law is very protective. But if you breach trust and you kidnap the manager of the sawmill and steal things, then
yeah, I remember you, I think you told the story on the podcast a couple episodes ago.
Then you can get fired. And so 50 people were fired. And then a month later, they protested that and basically, you know, burning tires on the street, same play, attempts to negotiate getting their jobs back while being armed with, not guns, but armed with pangas and burning tires and rocks, and they threw rocks at people that I spoke to. And after a week, the sawmill management said, look, we've got to get our people in. They called the police. They said, please be there. This is the plan. This is how we're going to do it. The police didn't really show up. And one of the actual workers was sort of trapped. Security guys tried to get out to help him out. They were then attacked from both sides, shot rubber bullets in self-defense on their version. But in the course of that, killed one of the protesters. It's a really tragic thing that just happens really often. I mean, South Africa, there really are 10 violent protests a day on average in the years before lockdown, and I think we're getting back to that. And so far in this case, it doesn't seem like anyone's died. So small mercy that is big mercy actually to be grateful for, and we hope it stays like that, and we will be keeping our eye on the story, and we hope you do too. But we should probably move on to.
Well, let me just say the thing you reminded me of very quickly.
Yeah.
So there's this thing I've seen, because you know I'm super keen on learning about medieval history, and there's this recurring thing that happens in medieval government, which is people don't have a vote, right? Because of course, you know, you don't vote for kings, as Monty Python reminded us.
Yes.
And yet, you need some sort of way to interact with the populace. You know, find out what they want, what they don't want, because popular opinion, even in that kind of system, does sort of matter a little bit. You know, if the peasants are all downing tools, it's going to be difficult to get in that year's harvest. So riots and violent protests were very much a part of the political culture. That was how you got attention. If you were angry enough about something to riot...
then
the local nobility or the king or whoever was in charge would come in and say, oh, clearly something has gone wrong. They'd slap a couple of people in the stocks, nothing too serious. And then they would try and fix the problem, and then everyone would go back to business as usual. Mm. And this was a recurring feature of English government for hundreds of years. It was a recurring feature of Byzantine government, where the people in the chariot stadium, the Circus Maximus, would chant slogans that were demeaning or in favor of a particular political position, or they might riot. And so this is quite, it's sort of like, I guess, vaguely, it's something that Fidel Castro would approve of. Fidel Castro once said, we don't need to have democracy in Cuba because we have direct democracy, which is that if the people really want to have their issues heard, they'll all gather together in front of my residence, and then they'll speak to me, and I'll speak to them, and we'll have a direct conversation. So I wouldn't call it a good thing, but let's just say that there's a very strong precedent for this kind of political culture.
Indeed.
And I'm not sure these are the societies we perhaps want to emulate.
Yeah, it's what I like about that is when people talk about technology, I think they so often focus on machines, on things with internal combustion engines or with silicon, you know, transistors, computers, digital
things
stuff.
Things that beep.
Yeah. and flashlights, but a voting, a ballot box, that's a technology.
That's a good technology.
What an old and noble technology. What a way to deal with the problem.
Underutilized for much of history, but very good.
Yeah. And a little bit underutilized in South Africa. It is just a damning fact that we have just about the highest protest per day sort of rate in the world, and one of the fastest falls in voter participation.
Exactly.
Our numbers in absolute terms aren't that low, but if you compare them to where they were just a decade,
Years ago,
it's huge.
Although our colleague Anthea Jeffrey has made the case that in 1994 they were perhaps not as high as they were recorded, but that's quite a controversial position.
I was thinking more of 2004. Four, which was the really big one. That piece by Anthea Jeffrey is definitely worth checking out. But we'll say that for our recommends. So the next topic that we wanted to discuss, I suppose, is a bit similar. It's just the George Floyd trial's conclusion. We talked about the trial. We didn't really get a chance to discuss the judgment. I think we did on the Daily French Show, but not on the Two Crickets podcast because we missed a week. And I think the thing that struck me, the judgment struck me as sound and judicious. The prosecution made a really strong case, both on cause of death being the knee on the neck and the pressure generally applied to his body, and
the improperness of him acting like that. So, I saw an interview with one of the jurors, actually. He was he's a sort of, I don't know, 30s, 40s, black dude. I think he's a basketball coach. Anyway, he gave an interview to the media, and they basically, he said, on his version, we all went in there with an open mind, and the dude looked, Chauvin looked very confident the first couple of days, and then after the medical testimony where the I can't remember what he was described as, a breathing expert, described the symptoms of a... Yes. Described the symptoms of dying from lack of oxygen. Basically, the juror said that was what swung his mind. And then he said, this is completely damning and it's really difficult to get around. And he said that the defense never batted that away successfully. Now, I mean, you know, I'm not enough of an expert in these things to know whether that's a good judgment or not, but that does seem fairly reasonable to me on the surface.
Yeah. I watched the defense's expert and he was torn to shreds. And, very conservative publications like the National Review also describe things that way. So I think the main thing just to notice is just these two kinds of technology again. The one kind of technology is like, okay, people are really angry that this cop did this thing, so you need to go outside and protest. And a lot of that protest does end up getting violent and lots of people died in the course of those protests and lootings and burnings and whatnot. And the softer side of that same technology is comes from politicians who try and influence the proceedings.
And we definitely saw some of that this time, which was very ugly.
In particular, Maxine Waters, who's a congressman, who said, you know, if they don't find Chauvin guilty, then we need to hit the streets again and protest some more. And and Biden's sort of rhetoric about the judgment not showing that America's system works, but really showing that America's system doesn't work and that it's still systemically racist because only one cop has gone to jail. The other cops are still on trial
it was a dumb thing to say, but Joe Biden has a history of saying somewhat dumb things.
But so there's that technology, right? The same thing of like, just, you know, people go out, the court of public opinion, which includes words, and some of those are smart words and some of those are dumb words, and then also includes stones and tires, and well, in their case not tires, but burning things and guns. And there's this other technology, which is the technology of the court, which is a very technical thing, yes. the requirements that need to be met, the way
Voidea, time to develop
jury selection. Yeah, just that technology is amazing, and I think it did really well.
So I think we're seeing a thing that we often see something in America. Now, I think there are definitely some criticisms you can make of the U.S. justice system, but in this case, it performed pretty well. We talked about that, like, not last episode, but the episode before that. And this, you know, it's a great showcase of this technology. But America's political scene, in contrast, did its best to kind of ruin things, particularly from the left in this case, particularly from people like Maxine Waters. And I think this is a recurring theme of America of the past couple of years, is that a lot of the institutions hold up relatively well, but the political scene is just the worst part of the situation in every case.
Yeah.
Which I don't think was always true, actually.
No.
Yeah, that's very concerning, I think, but as long as the other institutions manage to hold still, I think there's still hope that they can pull out of this strange place they're in.
Yeah, we must hope.
Indeed. As go they, so goes the world in a lot of ways.
And they're so full of hope. Yeah.
Yeah, no. We both of us are American files in our own way. Gabriel has much more practical experience than I do because I've only been there on holiday. He's actually lived there.
Yeah, I've been speaking with some of my American friends, actually. And they report to me some very positive vibrations, as it were. Every single American that I know has been vaccinated.
Mm.
So that's great.
Must be nice.
I am getting to the point where, like, I do think it's, you know, some people tease it like, oh, you know, you can get in an airplane and fly away somewhere without putting it on Facebook. You can eat lunch without putting it on Facebook. It's amazing. And the joke is, obviously, some people just feel like they can't do those things without signaling to the world what they've done. And the same goes against vaccine. People who get vaccinated and then put it up on Facebook, they're like, you know, why don't you just do it in quiet? Look, I like the idea of telling the rest of the world that you've been vaccinated, because I think that's actually the sweetest way to encourage people. I think hectoring people and shaming them for not wanting to get vaccinated, that's not great. Informing people, the best thing you can do is be like a journalist or a scientist or something and really inform someone about the cost-benefit analysis. But short of that, short of really trying to develop some layman's expertise, the best thing you can do is sort of just offer yourself up as an example of someone who's made a choice and sort of, you know, let people know that you're voting with your feet.
They did actually set up selfie stations, basically, next to the vaccine thing, so that people could take selfies in like a designated space.
In a
which,
spot.
On one hand, that's, you know, from an esteem economy angle, that's a pretty good thing for the most part.
Yeah.
But on another side, it's just a kind of, I find it, and this is perhaps where the esteem economy isn't entirely a good thing for the esteem economy. It also seems a bit creepy and dystopian. Like, when you think of everything that's wrong with the social influencer age, it does feel like that's part of it.
Well, so I think you have a pretty deep aversion. You've got like a deep suspicion of government's ability to manipulate the esteem market. Right? Is that what I'm getting? Like, if you see an American their own backyard, they like take a selfie and they're like, hey, I got vaccinated. That doesn't put you off. But because there's this government set up to amplify
that
signal,
that's part of it.
The government manipulation side of it. That's a little bit off-putting. And I share that suspicion in some regards. I think it is a little bit Orwellian. No, but of course, there's, you know, people play the national anthem.
There is more to it than that. There is much more to it than that. I'm actually more critiquing the private way that the esteem economy is set up at the moment to favor, you know, I'm sure everyone's seen those videos. Well, not everyone, but, you know, a lot of people have seen those videos where someone pretends to be doing a thing and then gets photos taken of them for Instagram and then they just stop doing the thing the moment the photos are stopped being taken.
Oh, yeah.
That's inauthentic. I can't remember. You know, there's 1,000 names for it, but it's the culture of everyone pretending they're a celebrity.
Yeah.
It's not good, I think, for our brains and for our happiness.
Well, I think something like that's I think it's complicated. I found myself when I was young, I would spend time on Facebook and I'd sort of write messages to friends on their walls publicly so everyone could see what I was saying and everyone would see what they were saying. And then I kind of – some older friends were like, dude, isn't that a bit weird? It really is like shouting across the room at the bar. Like if you're in a big, you know, crowded space, why not just go and like stand
what,
next
what
to them?
What year was this that you kind of did this?
2008, 2009.
Yeah, you see – I think that's different because that was like the kind of early stages of sort of coming to grips with this technology.
Yeah, I was learning. But everyone who joins is learning, right?
Yeah.
And some people join because they're 5 years old and they get a phone, and some people join because they're 50 years old and now they've decided to join. And right. I do think often it's the naives who make the most egregious mistakes. But anyway, the point is that I was trying to say is that I do think that it's easy to evolve, to become a little bit more private. And for me, there are sort of WhatsApp groups that I have become part of since I got a fancy work phone. And sometimes people do share pictures there and of, you know, a friend of mine, one of them that I'm on, there are a lot of engineers and a guy just got a new lubricant that sort of does great stuff for like a computer, supercomputer type thing. And so he took a picture of that and shared it with the group. Now he would have put that on Facebook 10 years ago. And there he'd be acting a little bit like a celebrity. And I think the danger when you put things on Facebook, one of the dangers when you try and act the celebrity is that the numbers, it becomes a numbers game. You don't see who likes you. You just see the number of likes that you get, and you got 40 likes or whatever it is. And that's not nearly as much as the big dogs who are getting millions of likes, like Elon Musk or whatever it is. But when you share it with your friends, if you find a platform that allows you to share just with your friends or with your family.
Yeah, I agree with that completely.
And it's like, great. You get that esteem that people need and that I think is worth encouraging. I'm so proud of my friend having done this amazing thing.
Exactly. That's a good kind of esteem in my eyes. That's the esteem from friends around you, from your family, from people who care about you, who you know, who you interact with. It's not the same as trying to sort of market yourself as a product for mass esteem and possibly financial or, I don't know, self-confidence rewards, which is the thing I'm specifically concerned about.
Yeah, just the dopamine hits, when you just want that dopamine hit of getting another ping to say I've been liked again.
You see it quite often now. You have kind of usually wealthier teenage girls. Or young women who are in their sort of early 20s, and you ask them, what do you want to be? What do you want to do with your life? And they say, I want to be an Instagram influencer. Mm. And, you know, I think there's a space in the economy for some Instagram influencers.
What's the line? Many are the calling, few are the chosen.
Yeah. It does sort of slash a knife across my soul a little bit, though, because it does seem a little bit like a waste.
I think it's a difficult space to really find a meaning that's more than just sort of sugar.
Exactly. Anyway, well, we went on a strange rabbit hole here, but I thought it was an interesting.
a little bit of a tangent, but I think the through line is just that what America's going through, South Africa is still in some ways yet to go through. They're further down the road in this, I think, than we are. Particularly on the plague side, so many people have been vaccinated, they can get back to normal. And that does mean some people tweeting about it one way and other people tweeting about it another way. But the real thing that's exciting my friends is seeing theaters and dance spaces open up again. Is seeing the streets get a bit of vibrancy back in them. Is seeing the restaurants sort of just feel a bit more alive, and the parks
humming with activity.
Some joy and some that dynamic sort of New York buzz. It's not all pistons firing yet, but some of that's coming back. And I think that's a wonderful thing to look forward to. I mean, I think in South Africa we're in this very weird space where we are so tired of being tired of not getting the vaccines if we want them, or telling people that vaccines are terrible if we think they're terrible.
Right.
You know, it feels so stale and it's so unmoved because of the glacial pace at which everything's happening, that it might seem that it's almost impossible to acknowledge. But there it is. The world's richest country is really getting back on its feet, and it's not the only one. It's just the one.
The UK is also that I've lived as well.
In. Yeah, my fiance's mom has been staying in Moscow instead of Germany for all of this year because she could get vaccinated in Russia. All of the family there is vaccinated, including the 22-year-old girl, the 80-year-old granny, the whatever.
And that's with Sputnik, right?
That's with Sputnik. I want to get a T-shirt. I've ordered a T-shirt that says from the sister that says Sputnik Sweetie. Because I want to be a Sputnik Sweetie. And in Moscow, the theater's been going and the ballet's been going. And it's just, you know, she was like, after she was vaccinated, my almost stepmom, she wanted to stay in Russia because she just said it was so much more alive than Germany was. And I think, this maybe people are just very used to this thing of like the masks everywhere and the slightly offishness. I mean, I was like at a kind of engagement party and there was a new baby there and it was beautiful in a park on Sunday. It was really beautiful. Mm. And at the same time, like people would hug each other and then they'd be like, oh, damn it, I shouldn't have done that.
Yeah.
Right. And just to be in a place where you can just hug people because that's a wonderful human thing to do. That's a great thing. The Floyd trial, I think, ended really well. Justice was served. So I think America's got reason to be hopeful. It's not just hope for its own sake. I think that the wheels are going to be turning there. And as you said, as they go, so much follows. I do hope that they create a good precedent that matters to South Africans. Obviously Israel, and there's so many other countries, and particularly in the Far East, that I care about, but that don't seem to influence our social space as much. I hope that America becomes more sane and more hope and more pragmatic in the rest of this year and the next to come. On the back of
this brings to mind something that's been buzzing around my head for a while, and actually I'd like your thoughts on it. People in the UK seem to be incredibly angry for the most part about how their government has handled COVID. And I know you in particular have actually had some criticisms of the early stages and the college report from that. What is that guy's name?
Neil Ferguson. Yeah.
Yeah. Neil Ferguson. Niall's the historian dude, isn't he? Yeah. Anyway. You had some critiques, and they were very good critiques. But I think, especially compared to other governments, which in a lot of cases is quite a low bar, the British seem to have come off much better. I mean, you know, look at how they've kind of been vaccinated so early. They have like dates for when they're supposed to open things. There's like a very clear sort of staged withdrawal from this thing, which a lot of other countries don't seem to have. They're kind of just making it up as they go along. Am I missing something? Why are Brits so upset with their government's handling of COVID beyond just the sort of usual, you know, too harsh a lockdown, that kind of thing?
Well, I think that Brits are disappointed. I think Brits are very proud of the National Health Service because of the bipartisan convention that's a really good thing. It was a contentious issue. The UK in the last 50 years has sort of gone through cycles of nationalizing and then privatizing and then renationalizing and then reprivatizing significant sections of their economy. And there was a question mark around whether healthcare should be nationalized or privatized. Once it was nationalized, a question mark about, okay, if you're going to privatize other stuff, shouldn't you be privatizing this stuff too? But for the most part, the right rested on the thought that, no, this is the kind of thing where we think governments are well suited. Well, governments as competent as ours in countries as rich as ours to do away. You know, basically there's just always this neighborhoods effect problem or third party costs with healthcare because someone who gets sick doesn't just impact themselves. They impact their dependents and their workmates and so on and so forth. And so They made the argument that we can do this more efficiently in many parts of the healthcare system than the private care industry might. And Brits have been very proud of that and consider themselves quite exceptional. Better than most of Europe, because they aren't as big government as France, for example, and Spain. But better than America, because whereas America sort of rejects the national healthcare system, they go for it. And so they thought that they were in this wonderful sweet spot. And then in terms of deaths, it just didn't look like that. It still doesn't really look like that, like they're that they're particularly good by European standards. In fact, they're quite weak by European standards. That's one part of
Some Brits have defended that's basically saying that they have some of the best screening testing regimes in the world. I mean, they identified one of the variants really early on, the one that they
But I'm not talking about cases. I'm talking about deaths. And their death numbers, whether you're measuring by COVID deaths or by excess deaths, are not as good as proud NHS members would have expected a year ago. Right. 2 years ago, in 2019, if you'd said this is going to happen, I think most Brits would have thought that they would have come up relative to France and Spain and Italy than they have, and America. So that's part of it. The other part of it, of course, I mean, we've got the Scottish national election coming up, and it looks like the SNP is going to win, which means that there probably will be a second referendum on whether France should whether Scotland should stay. That's a historical slip because France and Scotland were, of course, long allies against England.
The old alliance, yes.
But, you know, there probably will be – it looks right now like the smart bet would be on the United Kingdom falling apart. And that is a – falling apart in the sense that, that Scotland fully breaks away from the United Kingdom. And that is an existential threat in a sense. You know, I think Wales will stay and North Ireland will stay, but that's – North Ireland's also getting more touchy. That is, I saw The Economist wrote a very damning article about Boris Johnson, which at the same time couldn't but give away the sympathy which must now have grown in their hearts to him, because he might very well be the prime minister that presides over the dissolution of a significant part of the United Kingdom. And that's extremely traumatizing thing to consider. And I think that, however nefarious you consider any of the actors to be, whether your favorite villain is Boris Johnson or Nicola Sturgeon or whomever, everyone's going to have a story where there's some terrible bad guy. But whoever that bad guy is, I think no one fully likes the basic – in between kind of twilight zone that the United Kingdom is now sitting in. And I think that's the background temperature, which on top of a lot of deaths and a generally biting and acidulous media have culminated to make the UK seem like a very unhappy place. And of course, then you've got football riots for the first time since I was an adult.
They're upset about their owners.
Yes, well, because there's this great capitalist ploy to stuff the national kind of league and the UEFA league. Let's find a way to make the most money we can by having a short season with just the richest clubs, so that there's never a game where only loyal soccer fans are watching, but the rest of the world isn't watching. Right. Let's try and make it like a World Cup every year where we can try and get everyone to watch, and fans. Diehard fans are really not into that, so they have blocked off Manchester United from playing its, I think, a derby or it's.
They're playing Leeds or something, weren't they?
Anyway, it's one of its big fixtures of the year. That's been blocked by the protesters. So, yeah, I mean, what I'm trying to say is I think to understand all the anger against COVID, you have to see all of the anger that there was before COVID and that there will be after COVID. And of course, that is true of America too. So, you know, one mustn't get too hippy hopey about the bustle returning and people coming back.
When are we ever too hippy hopey?
Yeah. Well, maybe I was for a minute just now with America. But yeah, no, it's, I mean, the deeper problems are very real. And I'm more worried now about the UK than about the US. And that is not something that I felt I think since 2016. When Trump was elected, I felt the same. I felt very worried about the U.S. But then he turned out sort of not to be the what the New York Times had portrayed him as. And so that worry sort of slackened. And I thought, well, you know, now there's this Brexit thing, which is still sticking around and really is very dangerous. But I suppose it's just become so much more pressing with the polling in the build up to the Scottish referendum. And what a strange thought that we might, you know, live through so many, peaceful and wonderful kind of revolutions that seem to go in the right direction, like South Africa's. And now a revolution that'll be peaceful, but I think is going in the wrong direction.
Right. I must say, so, you know, I'm not always entirely sure what my heritage is, but Scottish is probably one of the things that could make a claim to being my sort of ancestral heritage. And the idea of Scottish independence, it awakens some sort of, I don't know, beetle-like animalistic response of fury.
The idea. You start talking in a brogue in your head about the damn fools of Glasgow.
I have ancestry from pretty much all over Scotland, from both the Campbells and the MacDonalds. I have an ancestor who is a direct descendant of Robert the Bruce, the famous independence king of Scotland in the 1300s, of his sister. Mm-hmm. And yet, the idea of an independent Scotland, particularly run by the SNP, who I think are just hideous, they're very much the villains in my version, It makes me sick to my stomach in a way that I'm somewhat surprised by because right. I don't yeah. really care that much. So I really hope that the UK stays together because, you know, as far as political unions go between people who used to routinely kill each other all the time, it's been pretty successful.
Yeah, it's been amazing. It's been really good. And what a way for it to crumble if it does. Anyway, we'll see about that.
Yeah, it's a long way to go. I think it's going to be close no matter what happens.
I want to talk a little bit about sort of those deep, dark feelings that you're describing with reference to a book that I've been reading, lent to me by
Not Seven Votes.
The Content of Our Character.
Oh, yes, even better.
So Sarah Gunn, our esteemed and wonderful colleague, lent me this book, and immediately I liked it for two reasons that aren't, I don't know. One of them is a really good reason. It's written by Shelby Steele, and we talked a little bit about Shelby Steele last year. He made this documentary called What Killed Michael Brown. Now, Michael Brown was the person whose death really made Black Lives Matter a national American phenomenon in 2015. And it was on the back of those protests that the Black Lives Matter movement won the Time sort of runner-up person of the year. And the famous line was, hands up, don't shoot. And that was the chant, because the story was that Michael Brown was being harassed by these nasty white racist police, and he said, my hands are up, don't shoot, my hands are up, don't shoot. And then he was shot several times, and then the police went and stood over his head, and even though he was already dead, poured bullets into his skull, and that several people had seen this, and that justice would never be done because it was a white cop and a black unarmed man. And so the first 20 minutes of the documentary basically debunk that version, which is very easy to do because there was huge investigative resources deployed from national level at the federal level, the FBI, who dug into this case to make sure that it wasn't police investigating each other that know each other and work together. And of course, the sort of head of the America's National Prosecuting Authority at the time was black, and the president was black. And it was all their appointees. So there was also no way to cast the FBI's investigation as being directed by terrible white puppet masters. And the hard evidence includes that the kind of stuff that I always like to go for, which is the material stuff. The singed, the fact that gunpowder was singed into the hand of Michael Brown, which indicated that he was shot from so close while he was reaching into the police car, hitting the police officer, and was then shot through the door, and the shards of glass and the way that the ballistics, the gunpowder melted into his skin, his hand was like right by the gun. There was nothing like that on the other version. And then, of course, it turns out that all, you know, that most of the witnesses who actually testified, who had seen it, and were black people of the neighborhood, described Michael Brown as sort of walking and then the police trying to stop him and then him trying to break into the police car and then getting shot and then running away and then turning around and running back. And it's as he's charging back and the officer saying, stop, stop, stop. And then he keeps charging and then the officer shoots him dead. And there's no executing shot thereafter. So witnesses, together with ballistic evidence, together with, other sort of hard evidence, all exonerated the officer in question. But that's just the first 20 minutes of the story, and then Shelby Steele gets into the rest of the story, which is, well, how did it get to be the case that Michael Brown sort of lived this life where he would go and steal – you try and
– cigarettes and stuff.
You try to buy stuff from a store using marijuana and then stole something from the store. The night before, he came and said, like, can I buy something? And they said no. He's like, well, here's some marijuana. And they're like, no, dude, we're not going to sell you for marijuana. And then the next day he goes.
It's a part of that story of a dude trying to buy McDonald's with marijuana.
Once. I mean, the barter economy, I suppose, still does have its loyalists. But it's like, how does this happen? How does this happen? How does this happen? And he gets deeply into the politics of it. And his own political history is that he was – he grew up, his parents were both capitalists and sort of ardent political activists. And so he grew up into this political activist household and himself was a big time activist in the 60s and wanted to be part of building LBJ's Great Society and sort of saying America's government made racial problems. So the government has to be the solution and you have to give free things to black people because they've had it so tough. And then he watched as those projects, literally the projects, the big buildings for the free housing and the schools, free schools and this and that, just all made things get worse. And he was amazed by that because things started out so bad and then they literally got worse. And then he became an intellectual and studied the figures and saw the various quotients, not just GDP and employment, but things like, you know, amount of time you spend watching TV versus amount of time you spend reading books. Number of families that have two parents, number of teenagers that get pregnant,
right,
and so on and so forth. Right. All these social markers in which you really see things getting worse after the civil rights movement, which was supposed to make things get better. And so he's dedicated his life to trying to understand this. And this book, so part of the reason I really wanted to read this book was because it's written by this guy who's very soft-spoken and very – he's just a beautiful man. He's very warm and sympathetic to people whose ideas he really disagrees with, because he really wants to understand how this works. The other reason I really liked it is because this book was written in 1989, which is my favorite year, because the Berlin Wall fell, because that's when the Nats decided to – well, that's when F.W. de Klerk released most people from Robben Island, Mandela only 2 months later, but that was on Mandela's own insistence. That's when the ANC and the SACP were unbanned and so on and so forth. So it's when South Africa made its way and it's when I was born. So I'm a big fan of this year. and I'm a big fan of this book. I'm only halfway through, but it starts out with this story. Sort of every chapter is like an essay that starts out with a story. And the first story is about these demons, a bit like yours, Nick, where there's a kind of irrational anger that you feel because of something about your heritage. So he's at a dinner party in 1989 or 1988. And it's in a rich suburb in California. And everyone at the party is white, excepting for him and one other chap. And they're getting along, and that doesn't seem to matter until – this guy says, you know, I hate it that I have to send my kid to a school where there's so many white kids. And Shelby Steele is like, dude, I totally understand where that anger is coming from because I felt that anger myself. This feeling of like being at a dinner party and everyone seems to be having a good time. And I'm wondering, am I really having that much of a good time? And like, what am I really contributing here? And maybe the reason I'm not fitting in is because I'm black, or maybe it's just because I'm not as interesting today as that person is, because I'm just like a little bit tired and a little bit overworked and like hasn't been my favorite work week or whatever it is. But here's something I can do that's really going to just be memorable. Like, if I do this at the party, no one's going to forget that. They'll forget the jokes that were told and the wonderful story about that holiday that you just came back from and whatever. They're not going to forget that I said, and you all agree, that it's shameful that my child is the only black child in her class. What a terrible thing. And part of what Shelby does with that story is something that feels so familiar to me, is sort of try and think about how basically I would say people compete for esteem through race. And I talk about white burden supremacists who in that kind of situation are like, oh no, that's terrible. I'm so sorry. And it is, we live in such a racist country and I'm so sorry. And I wish I could help you, but you know, we are raising some money for a scholarship just for black people or whatever, you know, so where they're really showing. But the way he puts it is, he says, seeing for innocence. So there's this tendency of the white crowd to try and describe things in ways that make them innocent. And sometimes that plays off by just pretending there's no issue to do with race at all, a kind of colorblindness that I'm not in favor of. And sometimes it's by saying, well, look, we were so guilty, but now we're so humble that we're really the innocent. And then the black guy, of course, in the situation is also seeing for innocence, in the sense that like he's reading the situation in a way where none of the issues in his life are his own fault. And he just puts something so simply about the word victim, which has been so bandied about. What is a victim? Shelby Steele defines a victim as someone who is not responsible for their own circumstances. And I thought that just really hit the nail on the head for me. That's the real choice, right? And that's where we as classical liberals do stand on the other side of the fence to some people. I think to us, a good life for an adult, I think it's different for children, but a good life for an adult means taking responsibility for your circumstances. And that is an uphill struggle, because in the beginning you don't have all the tools to really make things go your way. And yeah, when it's half and half, you don't kind of lean back. You try harder to really take responsibility. And the thing that you end up figuring out you can take responsibility most of is yourself, is when you wake up and when you go to sleep and what you eat and like what you do with your hours in the day. So that's the thing you really take responsibility of. And it's harrowing because you do realize that you're not all that. I'm definitely much less amazing than I thought I was 10 years ago, like when I was still a student. And even then, I think I had some strong awareness of my faults, but like, I know what it is to be at a party and just feel like the most uninteresting person in the room and feel like, what am I doing here? Like, sometimes I can have a good, but what am I today? I'm just like a little flipping leech, like sucking off other people and like don't really have anything to add. That's not a feeling that people have when they're in the exuberant phase of youth. Of course, adolescents often also go through that like really depro emo phase where they feel like, oh my God, no one loves me. But the thing to do is to work your way through it, is to really take responsibility. Right. And the alternative is to just really absolve yourself of responsibility, to find innocence, mm-hmm. This childlike quality. And that's where Shelby Steele starts, and then he talks about race holding, just as this kind of nice meme-y term, to capture what happens when someone holds onto their race in order to let go of their personal responsibility, white or black. Mm-hmm. It happens in different ways at different times in history for different races, but race holding is his version, is his term for this, this thing that's going on. And it is a little bit, I mean, you do see it in yourself when you feel connected to the Scots through a story about blood. And I feel similarly about the Welsh, you know, I do have some Welsh ancestry, and the thought of a Welsh person standing up and saying we need to leave the United Kingdom does irritate me in a different way.
Yes.
And I can feel how if I indulge that feeling, if I drank from it like an alcoholic, sort of opening the bottle of whiskey and just actually drinking straight from the bottle, not even just pouring it into a little glass, how I could become quite a different kind of person. And not necessarily a failure. Like, I might become, you know, quite successful in other parts of South Africa's media. I think, you know, they're definitely journalists, you know, that I know.
That kind of rage and emotional story can drive a person far to far greater heights than taking the more considered view.
Yeah. So, and I think that's part of what Shelby Steele keeps doing, is he keeps acknowledging that there is something very human and very delicious about race holding, or the racial fixation, or race obsessing, or whatever term you want to do. So that it's not just a dumb idea or a silly thing. You know, it's like, it's really, if you want to critique that, you've got to understand how appealing it is and how much it can do for you. And then figure out whether it's the case that the alternative is even better,
right.
and then show it to be so. And that's definitely what he's set me up to believe he will achieve. But right. As I say, I'm only halfway through, so I'm just in this period where there's this guy who's racking his brains and like literally pulling his hair out and talking about how he was this kind of angry young black man who saw everything through the lens of race, and then as he got a little bit older and a little bit wiser, he saw how the effects of that politics were collapsing everything around him that he cared for. And right. So he was forced to reconsider it, and then feels
so kind contributing of, to the very suffering he was so angry about.
Yeah, but then he feels wiser, but at the same time more impotent, more like
right.
incapable of commanding, like there's this magical power that he's had to let go of. He can no longer, because he no longer feels this way, he can no longer honestly ruin a dinner party.
Yes.
And he used to do it as a 20-year-old and as a 30-year-old, and he used to love it. It was amazing. There would be these people who had like prepared all week to have a wonderful gathering, and he, Shelby Steele, could put a thorn in their brains that they wouldn't be able to exorcise for months. And they'd all remember him and see him later at the grocery store and wave at him excitedly, like, we're still friends, right? You know, he'd make such a little celebrity out of himself.
There's I watched a YouTube video recently where a guy was expounding this theory that above all else, we desire to be powerful in some way. And that is, I think, quite a good example of that phenomenon, right?
Yeah.
There was something addictive about that power, about the ability to just say a couple sentences and just change the whole mood of a room. And make everyone desperate to seek your approval. That must be a bit intoxicating.
It must be. And I can see this. I'm starting to – I mean, from when I first went out in the Institute's vehicle, exploring rural South Africa, I started to see white South Africans flirt with this too. Like BE crime,
right.
Government mismanagement. Like, it's one thing to kvetch about that as a citizen, and there's important and informative and interesting things to say. And ultimately, it's my view that if we are going to get better, it's going to be by acting as citizens together. But in terms of kind of striking an emotional spear through the heart of your fellow dinner party guest, being whitey in rural South Africa and saying to a black guy, dude, you're richer than me, and your mother-in-law was not killed on a farm, mine was, and I'm an extraordinary victim because I'm white, and that stigma follows me around wherever I go. I could see that intoxicating force too, and I don't want to,
I've definitely come across people who, they're struggling to get a job because they studied interpretive dance or something, and the fact that they, just smoke weed all day. But no, the real reason is that it's BE.
Yeah.
It's like, BE is not helping, but dude, smoking weed all day and studying interpretive dance ain't helping neither.
There we go, dude. This is exactly, Shelby Steele has this beautiful story about his friend, his own close friend, who sold insurance in the 80s in America. And he says, I'm just not, he's in the same company selling the same product as a bunch of other guys, but he's the only black guy in the company selling. And he says, I'm not doing as well as these other guys because I'm black and people don't want to buy insurance from a black man. Then along comes a spider in the form of two new black employees who nail it and do amazingly well and outperform him and a whole bunch of the white guys. And then Shelby says, I could see my friend. He was at this juncture where it's like, do I take responsibility? Do I see myself? Do I see the weakness in myself here? Or do I double down? And he sees him play these conversational gambits where he's like, no, no, no. The thing is, those guys are acting white.
Ah, yes.
And my problem is that I'm an authentic black man. And the story finishes with it's not clear which way he's ultimately going to go. But you can see that temptation as well.
It's really crushing for one person.
It's so crushing, man.
Self-esteem is to realize that you weren't just unlucky. You were just bad.
You are part of the problem. Yeah.
Yeah, that's a horrible thought. And every one of us comes across that thought at least once in our lives. And it's very difficult to admit that we are the problem.
Yeah, dude, I feel like I come across that thought once a day. And I suppose there's a way that thought can also be energizing in a bit of slightly slower pace, but like a little drop, what do you get those things in hospitals? A drip, a little kind of adrenaline drip that every time I feel like, maybe I screw things up a little bit. I mean, I really do have this after every interview I do on radio or TV.
Yeah.
I beat myself up about some sentence that I said wrong. And this is not like humble bragging. Like there is always something that I could have done better. And I don't think that's true of everyone. I think there are really perfect interviews. And I aspire to one day.
There are people who are just beautiful. They can just do it. Now, I know how you feel. I'm just the same way about all the podcasts and stuff I do in particular. Same sort of feeling of, that wasn't so good, or maybe we shouldn't have talked about that, or, so it's exactly the same feeling. We are running out of time, though. We must draw to a close.
Just to finish this thought, I think the metaphor I'm trying to get through is that in a way a human being can run on two different kinds of petrol coming from the esteem market. And the one is where you're sort of motivated by crushing the world. There's this evil in the world. And you're out to crush it, and you're the angel, you're the innocent, and you hold on to whatever narrative is going to keep you in that position. And then you crush the world. Often you end up making things worse because you can't see the bad side of the bad effects of your own actions. The other petrol that you can sort of run on is self-criticism. And criticism that comes from other people that you really trust and know well. which is very close to self-criticism. Sometimes even but more also, important because others can that are close to you. So it's not the stranger who calls you a racist or a Uncle Tom or a whatever the nasty word is that changes your behavior. But it is someone very close to you or yourself who kind of just picks up on this thing. And that kind of energizes you to try and and it's like from unleaded to leaded to lead replacement petrol. Like I think you can make the switch. I think help steal kind of shows.
Exactly. That's a good point. I think another way you might be able to describe that is something like kind of honor. Like I think there's something empowering and energizing about the thought that you are honest with yourself and that you truly are unshackled from the world and that you are a master of your own destiny. You know, the sort of like the spirit of the poem Invictus. You know, and I think that too can if you manage to attain that, it can be intoxicating in and of itself. But it's not so easy as just telling yourself, oh, "I'm the master of my own fate," because it's very easy to slip into another mode of thinking.
I like that. So it sounds like what you're saying is if you do the race holding thing, for example. Then because you can't see yourself clearly, because you're seeing yourself through this filtered lens that makes you innocent, you actually are prey to manipulation. You're ultimately a pawn in someone else's game. Because if you don't fully understand your own situation, how can you be the full agent behind your own action? Whereas and so you might do more in the sense that you might make more money or you might
But you're not fully actualized, as we might say.
But if you actually know yourself, then you know in a sense that you're not a puppet dangling on someone else's string.
Right. It's encapsulated by, I don't know if you've ever seen that meme. It's a farmer and he's standing there and he says, "It ain't much, but it's honest work." That sentiment, that sort of, you know, it doesn't matter necessarily where I am. I just know that I'm doing a good thing, an honorable thing, the right thing. I think there is energizing power in kind of moral clarity and humbleness. Anyway, that got very philosophical.
I hope so, dude. I hope that energy. Well, let's hope that energy exists. We'll do a scientific experiment, and we will come back to you, to our listeners, and see if like Amarula, the humble energy really is out there.
Right. Recommendations.
So, I want to make my recommendation, Anthea Jeffrey's piece on the Daily Friend. What is it called, Nick? Can you?
The Truth About the
1994 election. And it's a précis of basically the last chapter of her book, The People's War, which I read last year, 2019, and is I wrote a bit of a review about it. You can check that out too, I guess, if you like. It's a really amazing book because the build up is that Anthea Jeffrey has sort of dedicated so much of her life to understanding race politics and lobbying and arguing against apartheid and trying to call for a dispensation much like the one that we end up getting. Particularly, you know, a lot of the Constitution is really stellar. And so she, like so many South Africans, is overwhelmed with joy in 1994 when we seem to have, you know, Nelson Mandela seems to have been elected in this fair way. But she's also got a needle in the middle of her heart that, like, every time it pumps is actually digging deeper into this raw flesh of knowledge, of knowing that the elections were not, by most reasonable standards, free and fair, by being intimately acquainted with so many people, stories who died in political violence at the hands of the ANC, and understanding because of her very deep reading, very concrete reading, just of what ANC documents said ever since Morogoro Convention in the 60s, I think it was, and the renewed attitudes, the connections to to what the ANC said that they learned from Vietnam and how the Vietnamese communists played the media game and so on. That she really understood that the wool had been pulled over South Africans' eyes, not in terms of the whole project, but in terms of some very key facts. Thousands upon thousands, tens of thousands of deaths in particular. And the weird process by which the election was decided, sort of being much more in cigar-filled rooms than in front of things. Sort of starting with the problem being that even the ANC's own polling showed, and all polling showed, that the ANC couldn't have won a majority in 1992. Because the IFP had much more support, and the NP had much more support, and there were various other parties that had much more support. And so the ANC getting from 42% to 62%, that extra 20%, which gave it the commanding seat in, not so much in the executive, but in the drafting of various policies.
The constitution and everything, yeah.
It's written in a very cold way, but if you listen very closely, I think you can hear the very human pain of someone confronted by a moment in history so profound that it can't just be good. So naively think of it as just being good. And she's definitely not arguing that it's just bad, but she is sort of shining a light on a part of our history that I was blind to, and that it's so tempting to overlook. So that's my recommendation.
Indeed. At the very least, it should encourage curiosity from future historians and such to look back and try and work out maybe what did actually happen, because there are details that are missing. This is part of the problem with this, is that we don't really know exactly who said what and what the final decisions and all that were made on. There's just sort of evidence that points in one direction or another. All right, so for my recommendation, we did actually want to talk about something kind of weird and obscure today, which was the history of the Delhi Sultanate, which is a medieval Indian kingdom, which I think we might slot into another episode. I don't know anything particularly good to recommend on that. I just read the Wikipedia page and I thought that was fascinating in of itself. So if you're very bored and have spare time, go look that up. But I guess the thing I might recommend is actually, it's an old clip from the BBC World on YouTube. And it's about persistence hunting, which is what's thought of as the oldest form of human hunting. And it follows basically a bunch of Khoisan Bushman dudes who are up in the Kalahari, and they are chasing down a kudu bull. And persistence hunting is a method of hunting where basically, because human beings are very good at running quite slowly over very long distances, because we sweat, because we have two legs, all these other things, we can literally run animals to death. And archaeologists and anthropologists and all that sort of thing think that this is actually originally how human beings would hunt. You chase after an animal until it dies of exhaustion, and then you throw a spear at it when it's very weak. You kill it. Or you start off by throwing the spear at it and just wait a bit to die from blood loss. It's very low risk to you, which is one of the great advantages of it. And it allows you to take down animals that are very big. And in this case, the kudu bull is huge. And in the end, once they separate it from the herd, the guys doing the hunt, they just say to they basically draw straws and they say, okay, you're going to finish the hunt. Mm. And one guy chases after the thing for 8 hours. And he just runs through the bush following its tracks. He can't even see it most of the time. Sometimes he loses the tracks and has to kind of figure out what direction it went. Mm. And eventually, at the end of those 8 hours, it collapses from exhaustion and he spears it to death. And, you know, does a little ritual thanking it for its life force and that kind of thing. So it's just kind of cool to watch that. Mm. And it reminds you that human beings are freaking awesome, terrifying machines.
We are very, very scary. Whatever the petrol is going into that tank is,
We are magnificent creatures. And if like a really skinny dude who does not look like he's had enough protein in his diet despite the hunting, can bring down a kudu, I think that should be inspiration to us all. And it's a big kudu too. It's not like little. They choose the biggest one because they know it'll tire the fastest.
Those horns on top of his head. Yeah. A lot of extra weight to carry.
Exactly.
On a long marathon. Mm.
Anyway, that is all the time we have for today for this episode. We hope you enjoyed and that we entertained you with our musings on various topics, and keep the flag of liberty flying.